Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You know, I have in my hands a book called The Importance of Living by Lin Yutang. Those of you who have listened to my show since 94 understand the charm of this man and how I've talked for years about the book, The Importance of Living, which I discovered when I was 18 and going through my sufferings of young Werther phase. And I thought, oh, life is horrible, you know, oh, I can't take it anymore. And I found this book, The Importance of Living, where he brought the yin and yang together. He taught me that we are basically, although we have a soul, that we're monkeys. Our bodies are that of a monkey. I mean, I know many of you are offended by that, but truthfully, you know, it's been put another way, that we're the Neanderthal diet. But you got to remember that there's the human body is that of an animal. No matter how you think you're saintly, the minute you disconnect from the fact that you have an animal body, you go crazy. And that's where all your trouble begins. Anyway, this book put me together because there were chapters in it like, let me give you an example. Lin Yutang, The Importance of Living. I didn't write it, by the way. I'm not Lin and I'm not Yutang. But I never saw a book like this which talked about views of mankind, Christian, Greek, and Chinese, our animal heritage, the monkey epic, on being mortal, on having a stomach, on having strong muscles, on having a mind, and on human dignity and the rise of human civilization. Then he goes into enjoyment of life. That's what I'm getting at. And he talks about whole chapters on sex, on celibacy, a freak of civilization. My favorite chapter was the enjoyment of living, on lying in bed. A whole chapter on lying in bed, on sitting in chairs, on conversation, on tea and friendship, on smoke and incense, on drink and wine games, on food and medicine, the inhumanity of Western dress, on house and interiors. And I remember I read this when I was 18 years old, which goes back quite a few decades. And when I first stumbled upon it, I was astounded by this. And it was a combination of sort of our animal bodies with our spiritual beings. In a way, I had never been able to unify the two. You know, kids grow up, they don't know what they are. Either you run too much in one direction or too much in the other. Either you become too much of the spiritual and you try to deny the body, or you become too much of the animal, you know, the pleasure seeker, and you deny your spirit. And this book, for me, brought it all together. And one of the favorite parts for me was Chin's 33 Happy Moments. And I don't know if the people listening to this show, since I'm in a sort of different mood today and I had enough with Obama, this stuff was good stuff, and it was the happy moments of a Chinese as described by a 17th century playwright in China named Qin Shengtan. And he wrote about, he sat with his friends when they were locked up in a temple for 10 days on account of rainy weather, and they thought about what were the truly happy moments of human life, moments in which the spirit is tied up with the senses. And he writes about them, and I'm not going to read all of them to you. I'm going to give you a taste of some of them, and you'll see if you get a kick out of them. Here's one. See if it strikes you as a happy moment in your life. I wake up in the morning and seem to hear someone in the house sighing and saying that last night someone died. I immediately ask to find out who it is and learn that it is the sharpest, most calculating fellow in town. Ah, is this not happiness? Remember this? Remember he wrote that happiness does not consist in the flights of poets, of that kind of thing, but happiness consists in getting your hair cut every 2 weeks and watching your neighbor fall off the roof. That's what I was trying to talk about. In other words, that's human nature, is this normalcy. And also, if you get pleasure in seeing someone you hate fall off a roof, don't be guilty about it. Everyone likes to see their evil neighbor fall off a roof. Here's another one. Wait. It has been raining for a whole month, and I lie in bed in the morning like one drunk or ill, refusing to get up. First of all, that unto itself is beautiful. We work so damn hard in America. We never lay in bed. We think it's bad for our hearts. The opposite is true. I'm a big believer in laying in bed. I believe that laying in bed is way underestimated. I think we're just crazy with our running and our dashing and our this and our that. Anyway, listen to this one. It has been raining for a whole month, and I lie in bed in the morning like one drunk or ill, refusing to get up. Suddenly, I hear a chorus of birds announcing a clear day. Quickly, I pull aside the curtain, push open the window, and see the beautiful sun shining and glistening, and the forest looks like having a bath. Ah, is this not happiness? Okay. Let's see then. Here's another. A few more. It's so disconnected from today. Here, I love this one. To cut with a sharp knife a bright green watermelon on a big scarlet plate of a summer afternoon. Ah, is this not happiness? You get the picture? In other words, can you see a watermelon on a hot day and just cutting it and get pleasure out of it? That's what he's talking about. We've lost this. We think that because the ad men have so jumbled our brains, the madmen, the advertising, that we have to go somewhere to find happiness. We have to buy something to find happiness. We all know that that's rubbish. I've long wanted to become a monk, but was worried because I would not be permitted to eat meat. If then I could be permitted to become a monk and yet eat meat publicly, why then I would heat a basin of hot water and with the help of a sharp razor shave my head clean in a summer month. Ah, is this not happiness? To keep 3 or 4 spots of eczema in a private part of my body and now and then to scald or bathe it with hot water behind closed doors. Ah, is this not happiness? I mean, does this translate well anymore? I mean, I love this book. It reminds you how simple things are. You know, a few more because it's getting one. Wait. A traveler returns home after a long journey. And he sees the old city gate and hears the women and children on both banks of the river talking his own dialect. Ah, is this not happiness? Now, let's say we don't have an old city gate and we don't have our own dialect, or do we? We certainly do have regional accents. How about when you've been on a long business trip and you come back to your city or your town and just the sound of the horns and just the sound of the cab driver, even if he's from Bengali, even if he is a Bengali. Isn't that what makes you feel good and at home and happy? That's what we're talking about. Here's a nice one. I am not a saint, and I am therefore not without sin. In the night, I did something wrong, and I get up in the morning and feel extremely ill at ease. I am not a saint, and I'm therefore not without sin. In the night, I did something wrong, and I get up in the morning and feel extremely ill and ease about it. Suddenly, I remember what is taught by Buddhism, that not to cover one's sins is the same as repentance. So then I begin to tell my sin to the entire company around, whether they are strangers or my old friends. Ah, is this not happiness? Sort of sounds like Oprah. Here's one that I've really lived by. This is me. To open the window and let a wasp out of the room. Ah, is this not happiness? That's a good one. Have you ever let a wasp out of a room or a fly and felt something? Huh? I have. I've done that. To see someone's kite line broken. Ah, is this not happiness? To see a wild prairie fire. Ah, is this not happiness? To have just finished repaying all one's debts. Ah, is this not happiness, Obama? Now, if he went to China and said, I'm finished repaying my debts, by the way, see if you can collect it. Then I would say I would love the guy. You know what I'm saying? To end that little... If he could go to China and say, you know what, let me tell you something. We owe you a couple of $1 trillion. You owe a whole lot of our T-bills. You own them. But let me tell you something, Charlie. Here's the way it's going to go down. We ain't paying you. We can't pay you. You're never going to collect. But I'm willing to negotiate right now 10 cents on the dollar. Then I would say, ah, is this not happiness?
Savage.
Bankruptcy judge orders sale of Peter Madoff's $270,000 vintage Aston Martin, a vintage sports car that helped drive Bernard Madoff's victims to ruin, and will be put up for auction in August. A Manhattan bankruptcy judge ordered him. Let's see which it is. I know Aston Martin's fairly well. Piles of junk by and large. Which one? English racing green roadster just before his record $65 billion Ponzi scheme, blah, blah, blah. Well, what year is it? Oh, 58 Aston Martin Mark III drophead coupe. 58 Aston Martin Mark III drophead coupe. Yeah, big deal. You know, by today's standards, most of those cars are not really that great. The limited production convertible is set to go under the hammer in August, with the proceeds going to pay back Bernie Madoff's burned investors. It will be offered for sale at RM Auctions' annual sale of vintage sports cars in Monterey, California. I don't know. What do you make of a story like that? He paid $270,000 for the Aston Martin months before his record Ponzi scheme collapsed in December of 08. That's Madoff's brother Peter, by the way. He tooled around Palm Beach, Florida in the 1958 Aston Martin Mark II Dropkick Coupe, but gave it up in a deal with a trustee representative early this year. Would you want a car like that? You really want that? That's something like when you grew up in the 50s, you know, Hugh Hefner, Playboy, you know, who still wants that? You really would want an old Aston Martin? Even the new ones don't. You want to talk about cars for a minute. The new Aston Martins, they look like Toyota Celicas, actually. The grills are nice from the front, but from the rear, they're very disappointing. They look like a Toyota Celica. They've lost all of that cachet that they used to have, James Bond and stuff like that. I'd rather talk about cars for a few minutes. Bored of politics, I swear to you. I'm falling asleep here. I got a cold. I had a big lunch, too. I had a business meeting for lunch, so I violated my diet. I can't help it. If I go to a business lunch, which is very rare, I usually violate my diet. I use it as an excuse as a party. So all of these very, very serious people are sitting around the table, very nice people. And I immediately ask for a pizza to start the meal in the Italian restaurant. I can't help myself. It's a weakness. If somebody could invent a medical something that prevents you from eating pizza, boy, I would take it in a minute. But I love the stuff. I just don't like old Aston Martins. I mean, you look at them. It's like an old Jaguar. Would I still want a 1959 Jaguar? Can you drive them? They stink. They emit fumes beyond belief. They're nice with an Abarth exhaust. I remember those days. Wire wheels, this and that. But who wants to drive around in a car like that, like a Strunge? I mean, you wind up looking like Anthony Weiner driving around in one of those cars, don't you think? Like, what? It's weird. I own a sports car. I'm ashamed to even drive it. I take it out at night when no one could see me. I feel embarrassed to be in a sports car. I like a four-door car that no one could see me in. I don't understand why people want to be seen in a car anymore. All right, if you have a sports car, get it with black glass so no one can see you. Do you actually think that driving an expensive sports car makes people like this want to be you? Honest to God. I mean, I look, I'm not lying to you. I own a Ferrari F430. It's a nice car. I love it. But I don't really drive it that much. I don't like little cars to begin with. It's too small for me. So it sits in the garage. It's nice to look at. And I didn't take it with your money. So you want to get jealous, you could do anything you want. I own a big boat. I didn't take it from your money. I earned it. Everything I bought on it with honest money. But I don't understand why anybody would want those older sports cars. What's the big deal? What, do you want to fix it again, Tony, from the 50s too? Fiat, you want a Fiat. Somebody would buy a used Fiat. I look, to each his own. Wisconsin, John, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, great to talk to you, and like you, I'm bored with politics too, so I'd rather talk about something near and dear to both our hearts, which is boating. Yes. One point in time, you had a radio show, and you were talking about your boats, and one of them, I think, was like a 26 or 27-foot Ranger tug.
Yeah, I have a 22-foot Ranger tug with a three-cylinder, 29-horsepower Yanmar diesel, the best engine I've ever owned.
Oh, I agree on the Yanmar, Dr. Savage. What, do you know what the pitch of the prop is? I'm trying to fix up an old 25-foot cruise.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I don't have that technical information. It's a honey of a boat. I bought this one. It's a runabout. And it looks like a miniature tugboat. And it's small. I mean, it's just for a runabout thing. It's one of the most enjoyable machines I've ever owned. You know why? Low maintenance, starts up every time you run it, you spray it down, and you walk away from it. You know, I have a bigger boat that I really absolutely am crazy about, but it's a high maintenance item. I just had the wood done, varnish, the rails on the big Grand Banks. It took like 2 months to have it done right, between sanding and putting on the coat and taking it. The woman who did it took almost 2 months to do it.
Was that the boat you're standing on the cover of the Savage Nation with the bay in the background?
No. That was actually a charter boat at a deceased friend's party, God rest her soul. And my son, who has the best eye I've ever seen, took that picture of me on the Savage Nation. It was just one of those happenstance photos. That's an astounding picture of me, where the Golden Gate Bridge is just behind my head in the shape of a cross. It's amazing. So what are you restoring, a wooden boat?
No, it's an old 32-year-old fiberglass cabin cruiser, 25 feet to run around the Bay of Green Bay in.
So what is it? You want to know what kind of propeller to use on it?
Yeah, what pitch of the prop? I tried a 90.
Well, what kind of boat is it? When who was the manufacturer? It's not Chris-Craft, was it?
Cruisers.
So you call the company and you find out the original prop. What engine do you have on it?
350.
What, a 350 short block, or it's a gas engine, I assume, right?
That's right, yep.
Yeah, I'm so unfamiliar with gas engines. I know a little bit about diesels only from having used them, and I'm crazy about them. They're amazing. 1-800-449-8255. Okay, now I'm going to get the car people who are going to get mad at me. Washington State, John, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Mike. I live in the Spokane area, and about 100 miles west of Spokane is a town called Moses Lake. And through word of mouth, I heard a guy over there passed away. He had a foundry. He's got a great car collection. He's got a museum over there, and I wandered over there a couple days ago. And they let me in, and he's just selling these things word of mouth. They're not advertising. There's just anything from 1914 Model A's, Model T's, all the way up to there's a 69 Super Sport Camaro in there that was an Indy Pace car.
And does he have any of the cars I mentioned, Aston Martin, Jaguars?
No, most of them are all American cars. There's some Nashes. I mean, there's everything in there. There's Hudsons.
You know, I absolutely admire people who can restore machinery of any kind. I have a real fixation on that. I love American workers who can take, I don't care if it's an old jukebox or a candy machine, and restore it. It's incredible. The same with cars. I love seeing people restore old machinery. I'm just saying driving them isn't the greatest kick on earth, if you know what I mean, not in this day and age. That's all. That was my point. I mean, I actually like to own a business that restores things because it's a satisfaction in America to fix things that were once beautiful and functional and, you know, restore them to what they once looked like. I have a 65 Caddy, for example. I took it out of the garage. I bought this car 10 years ago, and it's a 65 Caddy with 54,000 miles on a convertible. I'm thinking of selling it and putting the money into my legal defense fund.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Come on, that's ridiculous. But identity theft is something you have to take seriously. What if someone stole your credit cards and tried to destroy your life? Don't be a victim. Call my advertiser, LifeLock, today. Call LifeLock now at 1-800-LOCK-485 and get 60 risk-free days just for Savage listeners. 1-800-LOCK-485. Call them now. Talk radio is not only not dead, but talk radio is very much alive. Although the midstream media has been claiming for years now that talk radio is dead, that the empty skirts who have been saying that this is a medium only for fringe extremists or old men, that talk radio is only for old men, I've proven them all wrong. Talk Radio Network and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when? 2000? Now, we all hear that the Internet is the king, and a lot of people ran to the Internet with their advertising money. Yet everyone knows that no one's been able to monetize their investment in the Internet. Nobody. You see, talk radio is a medium that you can't hide yourself easily in. You can't hide behind a mustache and such. 3 hours a day, Jerry. 3 hours a day, Jerry. Mr. Mustache on Fox. And unless you have a massive production staff who is talking for you, you're not going to get very far, right? But I don't have a massive staff. I have a very small and very good staff. And when you do talk radio right, people get to know you. People get to understand that you're a real person and they relate to you. What I'm saying is I've proven that talk radio is a very vibrant medium today. People who listen to talk radio are more acutely aware of what's going on than the average American. Although the fraudulent elites, or shall I say the self-proclaimed drug addicts with microphones and cameras in front of their faces, laugh at you, the average listener to talk radio is far more knowledgeable politically than they would like you to believe. And by the way, listeners to talk radio vote both with their wallets and their ballots. Las Vegas, Kurt, what's your lifestyle question?
Thanks, Dr. Savage. I guess I'm just looking for some advice or to see what you do in my particular situation. Now, I'm 26 years old, and I've been married for pretty much 6 years now with my wife, and I've known her since we were 14, actually. We met in high school. Weren't high school sweethearts, just good friends. And as time gone by, you know, I joined the military, and I'm going to make it a career. I know that in my heart that I love it, and I'm trying to follow in my family's footsteps with it. And
beautiful.
That being said, too, I'm putting myself through college because I want to better myself inside that career and also have something I can do once
fantastic.
I get out after I serve.
Fantastic.
And as I'm getting older and, like, hitting it as hard as I can, my wife, she's just a stay-at-home wife, and she just, I mean, all I ask is please keep the house clean, you know, cook, do whatever you need. You just, you know, just support me at home because I'm going to do all the work. And just put yourself through school. I'll pay for it if we have to. I'll go any
route. But she doesn't want to go to school. She doesn't even want to do that.
No, like, honestly, we had the same exact classes this past semester, and it's a long story. But because of what she pulled, she decided to drop out. Although I was ahead of her in the classes, and I was basically giving her the work. Like, this is all you have to do.
Wait. Why did she drop out of school?
She just said she couldn't handle it because, well, we have a son at home, and he's a special needs child. But she said she handle anything with having.
All right, so she's a little overwhelmed from the special needs situation.
Yeah. It
as someone who had a brother, which I did, I don't know if you know, I had a brother who was born what they called brain damaged in those days. It seriously affects the other children. It affects the mother most profoundly, but it also affects the father profoundly. So you got to cut her some slack here. You know, she's filled with conflicts because both mother and father feel that they're somewhat at fault. And the guilt with regard to a special needs child is something that is never, ever discussed so far as I know. Yes, of course, you should focus on the child's needs, but the parents also have to be dealt with what they're feeling. I mean, you yourself probably have some problems with that, right?
Oh, I definitely do. And the thing is, this isn't our first child. Our first son, he actually passed away because of just a genetic malformation. And we found out through negligence of the doctors when they did genetic testing.
Oh, God, what a mess.
We were both
What a sad story. And you still have the heart to want to go into the military despite all of these terrible things that have happened to you?
Oh, yeah, I'm in the military. I've been in for about 4 years now, and I absolutely love it. I love doing my job every
day.
Well,
thank God you have a structure that is bigger than you, in which you can lose yourself. That is really the most important thing I have heard. But your wife is the problem now, correct?
Yes.
So what is it you'd like me to answer? I don't quite understand which part of this question I can help with at all.
Just with everything like weighing down on me, and just I just feel like I have to drag her along. It's not. I don't mean to be harsh about it. I know.
Oh, no, be harsh, because she's not listening to the show, obviously. Is that correct?
No, not at all.
Is she apolitical?
Is she political? No.
No, I'm saying so she is apolitical. She could care less about politics.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Does she know that you're very political?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Does she care about your politics? Does she find you to be too right-wing, too conservative or anything?
I find it bores her, you know, for the majority of it. It's like kind of.
Yeah, so you don't have that in common. You don't share a common political orientation, which is difficult. So what do you share other than the burden of the tragedies in between the two of you? Do you share anything else?
We used to have more common interests when we were younger and when we were friends, and and we still seem to share some when we actually first got together. But as time goes by, it's just more and more of his has just dropped off, and it's, you know.
How are you doing financially?
Financially, I take care of everything, and I run the house as far as finances.
No, I'm saying, do you have enough money as a member of the military to support your family right now?
Yes, I do. More than enough, actually. I've made some good.
This is an interesting thing because, you know, military personnel are underpaid to begin with, but here you are saying I have more than enough. So you're not a greedy man. You're a very interesting person. You're a very good person. You want to give to the country, and you are giving to the country. You're a good father. You're a good husband. And you feel that your wife is somehow not a drag on you, but you don't know how to motivate her is what you're asking, what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't know what to do. I'm like kicking and screaming in the dark, and I've told her that. Like,
and I assume you're calling this radio program because you have no one else to turn to. Is that correct?
I mean, I've talked to family about it, but it's like somebody who's not family, not a close friend, just somebody on the outside, just, you know, unbiased opinion, who don't really know either of us and just can hear the situation.
Well, there's no way to kickstart people. You can't come up with some magic idea like bring home a, you know, Barbie doll for her and she's going to react to it. I'm using a metaphor, of course. The problem here is systemic not between the two of you necessarily. But this woman has already, she's lost a child, right? You said you lost a child?
Yes, we have, and we're going to lose our
Okay.
second.
Now you have a second child who is developmentally disabled or what?
It's a whole slew. You probably know the terms. Miller-Dieker, lissencephaly.
Oh, God, you're a poor God. It's terrible. Terrible suffering. You've got to understand your wife is suffering. She's in very deep pain, and I'm sure you do know that, correct?
Oh, yes, I do.
So you're afraid that if you don't do something and you don't intervene, she's going to drift further and further away from you and further away from an active life, and she's going to become a complete vegetable lost to the world, is what you fear.
Exactly.
Where is her mother in all of this?
You know, I want her to progress in her life. And
No. Where is your wife's mother in all of this?
Where is she? Actually, another addition to the story is I'm actually slotted to go overseas in 4 days and for a year away from her, so she's with her mom in Florida.
Oh, my God. Is her mom at all helpful?
Oh, yeah, she's very helpful. She's a very, very wonderful woman, definitely.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do for your family only because you've touched me so deeply. It's not a big deal, but it's a token of my gratitude, and I'm sure for the people who are listening to this program across America, if you'll be so kind as to give us an address that is not on the air, but to my my producer on the Savage Nation, I'm going to send you a gift of $500. I just want to give you something personal for that, okay?
Wow, thank you. Oh, wow. I don't know what to say. Thank you so much.
Other than I'm sorry to hear you're going through such terribly difficult times. So I hope we don't get calls now of people who want money because I'm not going to give out any more money. I mean, it's just awful because as someone who's seen what a child who is handicapped does to everyone in the family without knowing, they don't do it. But what having a handicapped child or a developmentally disabled child, the effects upon the mother, the father, the other siblings is overwhelming. And people don't even understand it. And a father like this, who still has the strength to care enough to stay in the military and fight for his country, God bless him. I'll be back.
Savage.
Over 30 can't multitask. They can't multi-hear. They grew up doing one thing at a time. The younger generation can do multiple things at a time, but all wrong. They're able to multitask, but they do everything wrong. They can't write a letter correctly. They can't type correctly. Nothing. I never saw anything like it. People do everything wrong, no matter what you ask people to do today. They can't get anything right, particularly if they're under 50. They can't work. They don't want to work right. I was raised in a time when the work ethic was king. I mean, you had to work. You had to work, and you had to do a good job. It was an honor. It was a mark of a person's self-respect, dignity, manhood, to be a worker and a good one. That's how I was raised. It was drummed into me from early childhood. And then you wake up and you see children. They won't clean a boat. They won't clean a house. I mean, pay them. You can't find an American kid, a white kid, to do any kind of work. They won't clean a boat. They won't clean a house. They won't babysit. They won't walk a dog. They're a bunch of spoiled drug addicts. An entire generation of children raised to think that the world owes them a living, and they walk around with a snotty attitude that I don't know where it comes from. You know, I got to be harsh about this. I watch, you know, I largely live in the suburbs. I stay in the city part-time, and I move around through many locations for obvious reasons. But a lot of my time is spent in the safe white suburbs, so to speak. I mean, let's call it like what it is. No matter how liberal they say they are, they don't want anyone around them who doesn't look like them, even though they vote lib. That's the way they are. And you watch them in their child raising, and sometimes you have to shake your head, whether it be a young mother who probably is on a prescription drug herself, and all she's obsessed with is her abs, feeding her child a jelly donut and a cocoa in the morning on her way to school, along with his Ritalin tablet, knowing nothing about diet and a child's behavior, nothing. And she doesn't want to know about it. All she wants to know is to get the brat into school so she can go have the affair or go to the exercise class for 4 hours. Whether it is a pair of white parents who are a little older than I was when I had my first child, taking a brat to a restaurant, 8, 8:30, 9, I shake my head. When do they stay home with them? When do they stay home? Don't they do homework? Isn't there a safe time to go to a restaurant? Well, you don't have to listen to, and the crayons. Fine dining around a kid with a crayon or a coloring book? I can't even digest when they pull out the Crayolas. Why are they in the restaurant with the child with Crayolas educating them? And they always do it to show how smart they are and the child is. Last night I went to a place. It was downscale Italian. I figured I could escape it, but no, it got worse. There was a father at an adjacent table. I couldn't believe what I was listening to. I had to take the food home. I had to leave. Now, he wasn't a bad guy, don't get me wrong, but I had to listen to an entire lesson. As the children are eating, he says to them, during the Cuban Missile Crisis of the 1960s, who was president? I'm not making this up. And the children have to repeat to the father, who was the attorney on the U.S. Supreme Court? And I'm trying to eat. I couldn't even get a piece of bread down my gullet. So as I say, I packed it up and left. What is this lesson at a dinner? Why do I have to hear it? To understand you're a smart, liberal man, and you're intelligent, and your children are as bright as you, and they're going to learn to screw everyone around them when they grow up like you do for a living with your law degree? That's what you're telling me? That they're not going to be like the ordinary person, they're going to learn how to screw everybody, just like daddy? Why do I have to hear this? Is there no hour when there are no children? Now look, I love children, I raise children. But at a certain point, it seems to me it's child abuse to have them in a restaurant. So I say to myself, don't they do homework anymore? I know they don't babysit. I know they don't wash a car or a boat for a buck. They don't do chores. Do they do homework? No, unless the homework is how to put a condom on a cucumber or how to learn how racist white people are or to learn that marijuana is healthy for you and tobacco. I mean, tobacco is bad for you. Marijuana is healthy for you. So is there no time of day? When I raised my children, if we went into a restaurant and the kids started to make any kind of noise, I immediately picked them up. And I went out of the restaurant, talked to them. I said, look, there were other people. And even if they didn't understand me, I said to them, you can't make noise in the restaurant. There are other people eating, and they want to have a nice dinner. So please, if we go back, you can't make noise. You can't make one of your famous cocktails out of the salt and the pepper and the ketchup and the mustard and the soy sauce and mix it and pass it around. No, you can't make that famous cocktail that you two like to pass around with each other because I'm liable to puke on the table. That's in the Chinese restaurants. They used to make a cocktail. Do you have any idea that that's the reason the ancient Sumerians stumbled upon beer? It was because of times like this. When you have a situation like we have today, that's why the ancient Sumerians stumbled upon beer. You know how the story goes, don't you? Well, I may as well tell it. It's as interesting as any, having studied this for years, all of this stuff. Our theories, no one knows. I mean, the ancient Sumerians look like my uncles to me. I mean, I see the pictures, renderings of them. I guess I descend from Sumerians because they all look like my relatives. But the way the story goes is somebody ate some grain, some type of wheat dish or whatever, in the area there, the Mediterranean basin. And they spat it out. I know it's disgusting. They didn't eat it all. I was like, ugh, this is disgusting. Again, another night of grain? I'm sick of grain. I don't care how healthy they are. I don't want it. I'm a pew. Bah! And they spit in the plate, but they were starving. Days later, they went back, and there was nothing to eat but the grain that they half-masticated and discarded in the plate. And the guy ate it. Ugh, disgusting. I eat this guy. And guess what? His wife didn't look like she had a mustache for the first time in 25 years. His ugly little children looked like he could deal with them without wanting to throw them out of the cave door. In other words, he got drunk. Why? Because the half-masticated grain matter that he spat up fermented in the cave during that period that it was sitting there, and it was produced some alcohol. And that's apparently one of the theories as to how alcoholic beverages, better known as adult beverages, developed in history. Ladies and gentlemen of the Savage Nation, I'm glad I could share this moment with you. Another moment in Savage history on the Savage Nation. It's actually probably, according to what I've read, true. And by the way, guess which culture? You're not going to believe this one. This is a real, you're talking about historical ironies. Take a guess which ancient peoples first developed wine from the grape. Buzz, answer. The same country that's now dominated by the invader from Turkey, Iran. In other words, the ancient Persians, allegedly, or it is thought historically, were the first viticulturalists on the planet. Well, take a look now. You got an invader from Turkey named Ahmadinejad, who was apparently, according to Iranians, is not even of Iranian descent. He's an invader. He's like a Hun. I mean, excuse me, like a barbarian invader. And he is the most anti-alcohol, anti-freedom guy in the history of Persia since King Haman.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started into hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway. Wait till our lips, they have...
Tucson, Arizona. Brent, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, I was just wondering what Teddy will be doing for Thanksgiving this year.
That's not a bad question. Everybody wants to know Teddy's comings and goings, so... Let's start with what he's doing for Thanksgiving. Teddy is going with Dad to all the family's going to be together for the first time in a long time. Son, daughter, in-laws, all in one house, all for Thanksgiving. And it's making me very happy, to be very honest with you. The word happy doesn't have any meaning to me. A good feeling in me, okay? I want to be together. It's my favorite holiday of the year. So we're all going to be together. I don't know if Teddy can be there, though. I haven't worked this out because they have a dog who's a little aggressive. He has to wear a muzzle, and he's much bigger than Teddy. I really haven't figured this out yet.
But I don't know about a Thanksgiving without my dog. You know, that's a problem. But if he has to stay with a dog sitter, okay, we'll do that for the day. I'll bring him home turkey or whatever, right?
Yes.
But it's going to be a nice day. You know, what you do, you eat, then you walk around the street. You pick the hood up of your old Cadillac and show it to an in-law. You know, that kind of thing. You know, you look at engines. What else are you going to do? It's fun. It's American. You see the other families, the normal families together, which is nice. I like looking at the other families on the street. It's a pleasure. This is so opposite to the vermin in Occupy, although many of them have gone home for the holidays. You know, it's Thanksgiving break for the college brats who are camping out. You notice the tents are mainly all gone because they got Thanksgiving break came the next day. They timed it to coordinate with Thanksgiving break. They never study anyway. They take courses such as women's studies, ethnic studies, you know, that kind of thing. Environmental studies, all meaningless fields. Any other questions?
Years ago, you told a story about the men in the family would consider it a good meal if they all got so stuffed they just hurt.
they all passed away very young, but it's true. That's how men ate in those days. God, you're going back 10 years, Brent.
Yes, yes.
I'll tell the story again because it is around the holiday times, and nobody wants to hear my brilliant satire. This shows you if you stick to the low road, you get a bigger audience. Anytime you go to the high road, the 99% of your audience leaves you. You can't do it. You cannot. It's pennies for Beethoven. What can I tell you? You want to tell that story again? Okay, I'll tell that story again. So once upon a time in the United States of America, many years ago, there was a thing called family. And the family consisted of a mother and a father, and usually the father went to work and the mother stayed home, and she was known as a homemaker. And she kept that home perfectly, and the children always had someone to come home to, and there was always a hot meal, and the beds were clean, and everybody was kept straight up. And that was America. That was the America I grew up in. So when the holidays would come around, the family members obviously would get together, and it was usually in my house because my mother loved to entertain and cook, God rest her soul. I know she's in heaven cooking for God. I just know that. Positive. I don't know what cuisine he likes, but whatever he likes, I know she's in the kitchen. So her favorite thing was to prepare for a week ahead, maybe 2 weeks ahead. She'd start getting all the ingredients and the dishes and lay them out. And it always made me feel good, as I was still going to school the week before Thanksgiving, to see all of the holiday dishes not exactly laid out in the way they were going to be for the night of the Thanksgiving, but kind of lined up, taken out of the cabinets. It always made me know, you know, it was like building up. It was like a theater in the house. It was a little house. The house was 20 feet wide. The lot was 100 feet deep. It was an attached brick house in Queens, New York on Utopia Parkway. And that's upstairs you had three little bedrooms and one bathroom, and downstairs you had a half a bathroom. My mother could turn out a dinner for 25 people on a four-burner electric stove. She didn't have the $2 million kitchen from Westchester or Tiburon that nobody cooks in. You go to a house today, $1 million kitchen, the latest in this appliance, the Gaggenau this. You can gag on the food they make there because they don't make any food. Gaggenau, Schmaggenau, every convenience, triple refrigerators in the pantry, and there's nothing in it but a Diet Coke and a bottle of vodka. But in those days, my mother had one refrigerator in which she could prepare. So anyway, so to make a long story short, we'd all come over. The men would come, the uncles, the this, the that, and they'd eat. Like, eat and talk, and everybody would be. You'd have to walk around the dining table. It was such a small dining room that you risked castration if you tried to. If you didn't bend back, like as you were passing a chair, you risked serious injury to your male parts. So you were constantly, like, you know, having to bend over. Then you'd hit your head against the women's, like, sprayed hair. It was crazy, but it was wonderful. So after the meal, the menfolk would retire to the small living room, which consisted of a large sofa and about four armchairs, you know, this place. And they would all lean back gagging from the amount of food that they ate. Because if they weren't going, oh, God, and they would slightly open their belt and they would just let their stomachs kind of, you know, expand. See, this is the beauty of the Middle Eastern costume. The Middle Eastern men have it down pat. They wear robes, man. So they don't have to unleash their belt. They eat a big meal. No one knows what they ate. They didn't eat for a few days. Nobody knows they didn't. Anyway, so in our society, we wear belts. Probably one of the most barbaric costuming devices ever invented, a belt for a man. It makes him conscious of his stomach, and it hurts you. It compresses your So the men would sit there gagging and moaning, like, you know, that kind of thing. Now, I know I'm not alone in this because I know many, many people are laughing right now because they grew up in exactly the same kind of situation because the object of a holiday was to stuff yourself until you were in pain. Now, that's all gone. It's true. It's good it's gone because eating like that is very unhealthy. It's far better to have a tofu turkey and talk about Occupy Wall Street and the meaning of it and how significant it was and how it brought about change for a betterment of society and nibble only on your tofu and be lean and perhaps immediately do your cardio after eating your tofu and certainly don't enjoy anything with the meal. In fact, don't even let a sigh of relief come out of your body. That's the modern man. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Well, he did ask if I could debate here in Washington on Monday. It is my understanding that such a letter has come in. Monday, I'm going to be in Portland in the morning. I'm going to be visiting some of our labs in California in the afternoon. That's two. I can't remember what the third thing is I'm going to be doing. Thank you all very much.
President Obama, he signs a law supporting global press freedom, which is very good, called the Daniel Pearl Freedom, the Press Act. Now, here's what I want to ask you. I want to read this to you for a minute. It will shine a brighter spotlight on governments that tolerate or sanction press freedom violation. The law directs the State Department, that's Hillary Clinton, to include in its annual Global Human Rights Report information detailing the state of press freedom and the extent to which governments are supporting or tolerating or are actually involved in violations. In addition, the United States will look at actions governments take to preserve the safety and independence of the media. I agree with everything. It goes on. The Daniel Pearl Freedom of the Press Act requires Hillary Clinton's State Department to include in its assessment such things as direct physical attacks, imprisonment, indirect sources of pressure and censorship by governments, military, intelligence or police forces, criminal groups or armed extremists or rebel groups. Now, you know I was banned in Britain for things that I allegedly said and things I allegedly wrote. Isn't that an indirect source of pressure and censorship by the UK government? Talk Radio Network, which is an independent syndicator. I have no pressures that I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do, where they have to answer to a lower authority. Indirect sources of pressure and censorship by governments. So therefore, this government, I believe, our government has to intervene on my behalf. President Obama said the law sends a strong message that the U.S. government is paying attention to what other governments do when it comes to a free press. Plain and simple.
Anytime you have a gathering, homeless people are going to show up. They will find some comfort in having some other people out on the street with them. They're looking for food. Oftentimes a criminal element will invade. That's life, and it happens, whether it's with protesters or other efforts that go on in this country.
Did you hear that? And it's organizations like the AARP who control these leftist politicians. AMAC is fighting back. The Association of Mature American Citizens. Your membership can help stop the left wing. Call 800-255-4199, 800-255-4199, or go to americaisrising.com, 800-255-4199, americaisrising.com. I'm not really boasting. I'm here with a dog alone in a room. Ask people who know me. That's my life. I don't even want to go out for dinner anymore. I can't take it. I can't listen to people in restaurants. Is that a mental illness? Not being able to listen to other people in a restaurant? You know, that may be a DSM thing. Inability to sit in restaurants and listen to others. But it actually goes back to my grade school teacher, because I remember in the fifth grade, fourth grade, third grade in the Bronx at PS 48, they had report cards. Today, I don't think they have report cards. Today, the students give a report card on the teacher, because it's exactly the opposite. It's communism today. Today, the gangbanger gets to report on the teacher to the goon in the principal's office who's snorting coke, having sex with underage children, and robbing the school district. And then they attack a teacher if the teacher actually demands anything of them. But in my day, they had report cards. So, you know, you got the regular thing in reading, A, B, C, D, E, writing, A, B, C, D, E, whatever, A, B, C, D, right, and F. Then it came down to character. There was a whole section in the report card out there. This is like the Dark Ages. They wouldn't even dare have character things like that, right? Attention span.
That would be considered a violation of the civil rights of a person who's a goofball and can't focus in the classroom. Okay, attention span, they would have given me. the one I'll never forget as long as I live, it said, respects the rights of others. I always got a D in it. Now, what do you mean by respects the rights of others? I talked over other people. I wouldn't listen to the teacher. And the teacher would ask me a question. I'd laugh at her. I was always goofing around with another kid in the class who was a basic clown. In fact, she separated us in the classroom when she put him in a diametric opposite from me, in opposite corners in the classroom, because we were always like egging each other on. So they put Barry on the front right seat and me on the rear left seat, right? So Barry and I were bored. We couldn't goof around with each other. I remember this as long as I live. So we devised a string system under the legs of our chair, like prisoners in a way. Because school was prison to me, to be honest with you. How did I stay so many years and get so many degrees? I don't know. I hated school. A jail filled with bad toilet water on the teacher's fat legs. So Barry's in the right seat. I'm in the left in the back. How do we communicate? We ran a string across the bottom of the classroom floor, around the chair legs, my chair, his chair. We had to get all the other kids involved and not get caught, by the way. That takes a lot of work. We'd egg the kid next to us, pass it on, like in a jail. Think of a 1945 a prison movie, like a black and white movie, right? And they got, pass it on. So you'd nudge the kid next to you when the teacher had her back to you, pass it along, the string, right? And we tie a note to the string, and then it would be passed along from Barry to Michael, Michael to Barry. That's what we had to do, in other words, in school. So because of that, I got caught enough times, they gave me a D in respects the rights of others, okay? That kind of I'm just remembering silly things. Who would have ever expected that I'd be so successful as a broadcaster and an author? I truthfully, my poor father died thinking I was a total and abject failure who would amount to nothing because I didn't do well in the antique store. I'm sorry. It's just another world. It's just, I'm not laughing at him. I'm laughing with him, truthfully. You know, if he was alive today, he wouldn't be proud of me. He'd be putting me down anyway. Let me tell you that right now. Cymbal shot. I know people say, oh, don't worry, Mike. If your father was alive, he'd be so proud. No, he wouldn't. He'd be seeing if he could run me down and make me feel bad. You know, that's the way it is. I'm telling you, families, don't count on your family. My immediate family is one thing, but I'm talking about outside the immediate circle. Not one relative, even those who have fed off me for a few years, have even sent me an email saying congratulations on the new book. Not one of them. Never. None. It's unbelievable to me. I mean, what does it say about them? I don't need the email. Wouldn't you think you'd be proud of a family member? Wouldn't you want to be part of it? Wouldn't you want to come along for that ride? Wouldn't you want to taste some of that stardust? Wouldn't you want to bask in his happiness for a few seconds? Look, all we have on the earth is a short dance in the sun. I've told you that. All we ever get is a short dance in the sun. And people don't even understand by being spiteful to the next man, what they're doing is they're cutting off their own legs. That's the point of the whole story. All right, let me move on. It was a long-winded speech about etymological, you know, roots and words and all the way back again to my fifth grade experiences. And I'm having a nice time. I don't have any pain in my chest, no pain in my heart, no pain in my legs, no pain in my joints. Although my knees hurt because I cheated on my diet today and got a pizza. I ate dairy and my knees are killing me. I tried to trick my body. You can't trick your body. Did I tell you that 3 years ago I was limping? I couldn't walk? I swear to God. My joints were shot. My arches were so painful. I have a picture of my son. He took us on a trip to Mexico. Remember I told you about the bed in Cancun that had blood on the mattress when I got there? What a shock it was. He said, Dad, come on, we'll get you. He got me the best room in the hotel. Top floor, corner, so Dad has air. Dad doesn't like going anywhere. Dad is like a character from another era. I don't like really going anywhere. I like my own little village, right? I go with them. I get there. And the bed, I don't know, like there was something wrong with it. I pull back the cover. There's a huge blood stain, about a foot wide, dried blood on the mattress. Swear to God. That was in a hotel in Cancun. You know, that today they're finding heads hanging from lampposts there. Oh, what bad people were in the lobby of that hotel. I could feel it, man. That was bad then. I could just feel it. You know, you could look at certain guys and know that they're murderers. You ever get that feeling? I got an elevator like a few weeks ago. Yeah, it was in my building now that I think about it. This guy gave me the creeps. White guy, 5'9", lean. He was a murderer. Never saw him in the building before. Now that I think about it, I think I'm changing my address. I'll be right back.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Joining us now is Herman Cain, once again on the Savage Nation. Mr. Cain, it's a real honor.
Michael, you are a great friend, and I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, you know, your honesty and your character is shining through for reasons that I don't have to spell out. You're a very busy man. You've gone into the international spotlight. You're not doing much radio anymore, and I understand that you personally told your staffers you wanted to come on to the Savage Nation. Is that true?
That is absolutely true, and the reason is because you and your audience were so kind to me when I was on first. You didn't know that much about me. They didn't know that much about me. And I respect you as a patriot. I respect you as a professional. And I respect you as a man of integrity. And I said, yes, I wanted to be on Michael's show as soon as we could set it up.
That's beautiful. So let me ask you a blockbuster question.
Yes.
If someone else were chosen to run for the presidency, Mr. Cain, would you accept the VP slot?
It depends upon who's asking and the conditions under which they would like for me to do it. First, I would want to know clearly what my role would be. Secondly, if we are ideologically and idea-wise so far apart, I cannot do that because I believe the vice president should be a spokesperson for the president. For example, Mitt Romney, with all due respect, he has a 59-point economic growth plan that's got all kind of stuff in it. I don't agree with that. So right now, today, I could not be out there helping him promote his 59-point economic growth and jobs plan. I couldn't do that. I like him as a businessman. If he gets it, I am going to support him. But I have to work with someone that I could compliment, not someone that wants to put me in a role that I would not want to do.
That's interesting because, again, Herman Cain, going into the third person, answers as directly as possible, given that we didn't rehearse this question. It's astounding to me what kind of... No, I mean, your answers are straight up. It's as though you and I are talking in a restaurant over a pizza. I mean, over a pizza. I'm asking a real question. I'm getting a real answer instead of double talk and footwork. Okay, so let's go to the next question that came into my mind that I think is a very important one. Given your background in mathematics and computer science, which I continue to boast about to people, you know, to this day, they don't know that you have a real degree in mathematics, a real degree in computer science, that you, Herman Cain, worked as a civilian employee of the Defense Department analyzing ballistics for the Defense Department. And when I read the elite snot noses on some of these shows are laughing at you and saying you're not smart, you know what I say to them on this show? Right. How come he can do things like that if he's not so smart? Most of these people couldn't do what you did in the military. I mean, for the military. So having said that, which cabinet post, let's say you're not picked for VP or president. God forbid, I wish you are. But let's say you're not. And someone says Herman Cain is so great, the people love him. We'd beg him to run a cabinet office for us. Which one do you think would fit for you?
Defense Department.
Yeah, I swear. I said that to my audience an hour ago. Mr. Cain, I swear to you, I said that.
And here's why, Michael. Here's why. I want to be in a position where I can make a difference. And now I would only accept it if the president asking me to do it would understand that, one, I don't want the product to be on cutting. I want it to be on investing. Two, I want to upgrade one of the things that I want to invest in is our ballistic missile defense capable Aegis warships. And I want to double that fleet. Why? The world is not safer. And so I want to build our military, not tear it down, because the world is not safer. So that would be the one that I could be excited about to help the generals and the commanders on the ground to get what they need to do what they do best, and that is kick the you-know-what out of everybody in the world if something breaks out around in other parts of the world.
I felt that that would be... If in that position came around, that would be the number one selection, A, because of your mathematics background.
Yes.
And there's another reason. If I said it on the show, so I'll say it again, Mr. Cain. You probably didn't hear it. You were busy at another show or on a campaign trail. I said that if Mr. Cain walked amongst the troops as the Secretary of Defense, they would get a tingle up their spine because they would love him. They would love this man, and he would inspire confidence in the troops. I mean, this is the reality. So let's go to the next question. The other night there was a disaster for Mr. Perry. He drew a blank, which was embarrassing. There's no point making a joke of it.
Right.
Would you eliminate any departments if you were president, and which would they be, if any?
I wouldn't approach it that way. You know, he's trying to identify three departments. Here's how I would approach it. I would do an across-the-board cut of 10% of every agency except for defense. I would review that to see if we got the right priorities. Then each of my new cabinet heads, I would then ask them to find another 10% by doing a deep dive. You have to go into each department and find programs that are outdated, obsolete, or conflict with some of our other programs. Now, once we do that, some departments may be totally gone. But I don't want to make that judgment without looking down in the belly of each one of these. But I do believe we're going to find at least a 20% cut in total in that first year, because we're going to go at it the same way a businessman would go about cutting costs. So I would,
you know, Herman Cain, you and I agree on, I mean, our minds work in a very similar manner, because I, just before you came on the show, I read my 37-point manifesto, my own, from my own book. And in that book, I didn't call for eliminating any departments. I said, cut them all across the board, because that's how a businessman would approach it.
Yes, that would be step one. Step two, do a deep dive. That means that you got to do the heavy lifting of saying, let's put every program on the table. What are the cost benefits of this program?
Mm-hmm.
If those cost benefits do not justify themselves, it is gone. That's how you go about doing that in business, and that's how we ought to be doing it in government. You know what, Michael? One of the reasons that, you know, each year the Government Accounting Office puts together a report identifying waste, fraud, abuse, duplication, and all that kind of stuff. They send it to Congress, and nothing ever happens. Why? Because if they are not trying to protect their pet program, they're trying to protect the pet programs of their friends. But guess what?
Mm-hmm.
I'll be a president with no friends, so I'm not going to try to protect anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make
I know your time is extremely short, Mr. Cain, and I have this question. A lot of people ask, I said, what would you like to ask Mr. Cain? We had hundreds of people calling. The switchboards were jammed. One of the questions they all asked was about the UN. What would Herman Cain do with regard to the U.S. participation in the UN?
I would bring about an attitude adjustment with the United Nations. That means we are not going to compromise our sovereignty under any circumstances. Secondly, I would make sure that the UN understood that because we are the biggest contributor to the existence of the UN, we are going to change some of the rules that they use, you know, in terms of some of their practices. For example, I will not sit by and allow a pipsqueak potentate dictator to come to this country and insult our president. I don't care who it is. That makes absolutely no sense.
Mm-hmm.
We should be respected as a nation, even at the United Nations. And so I believe that there's a way to do that. In fact, I have talked to some people who have suggested how we can do that. We need an attitude adjustment with the United Nations. I don't want to say we want to get rid of it, but we need to have a change of attitude and change the way we deal with the United Nations. And
I agree 100%, and I think that there could be a role for a UN if it was put in its place. And I think here comes the most important question, which is about jobs. Because people called and said, how would Herman Cain restore jobs in America? And we talked a bit about the exporting of jobs. We talked about Bill Clinton sending factories, letting China buy entire manufacturing facilities and bringing them to China. My answer was rather simplistic, but Donald Trump was on the show and agreed with the same principle. I said impose a tariff on goods from China. Now, do you have a position on this issue at this time?
Here's how I would bring jobs, keep jobs here. It starts with throwing out the current tax code because it is a mess. It works to our disadvantage. And this is why I proposed my 999 plan. Now, let's look at the first nine. This is where we level the playing field between U.S. manufactured goods, Chinese manufactured goods, to some extent, by the following. You take your sales as a business in the United States, and you're able to deduct purchases that you made from other U.S. companies. You're able to deduct capital expenditures. In other words, no depreciation. If it costs you $500,000 to buy a new piece of equipment, you can deduct it. And you can deduct net exports. In other words, you don't put embedded taxes into the cost of a car or a bicycle before you send it overseas. That makes our products much more competitive. We would be the most business-friendly country on the planet, Michael. This is how we deal with China, because then we'll be able to better compete against China and all of the other countries. As far as imposing tariffs, if we do my plan, we won't have to impose any special tariffs.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting and very intriguing. The issue of jobs, of course, is most important to most voters, and I think the bread and butter issue is the one that will launch someone into the presidency or keep that individual from arriving there. And the jobs. I mean, that's the number one issue. The unemployment is catastrophic right now, as you well know. I think it's related to all of the issues that you just mentioned. Is there any overall comment, Mr. Kane, that you any concept that you would like to leave the Savage Nation audience with that would be significant in terms of your vision?
A Herman Cain presidency would first restore pride in being part of the greatest nation in the world. A Herman Cain presidency would put United back in the United States of America. Herman Cain would not try and divide us based upon class warfare. I will not divide us relative to race politics. I will unite us because it says United States of America. The other thing that Herman Cain will do, and I happen to believe that the power of my 999 plan is going to boost this economy, because we are going to remove this veil of uncertainty off of this economy so businesses can get excited about growing again. I'm about moving that shiny city on a hill that Reagan talked about back to the top of the hill where it belongs. And I will never be one to apologize for the greatness of this country. I have achieved my American dreams and then some. And I'm not doing this for me. I'm not doing this for the people who have already made it. I'm doing this for the children and the grandchildren.
And I believe every word you just said. Every word you just said is coming from you, from the honesty of Herman Cain. And you're the only candidate that I know of who's even talked about restoring the pride of America. It's the number one issue that's not being talked about, which is the collapse of the heart of America, because we've been beaten up so badly. And God in heaven, just the spirit, just lifting up the spirit would be enough to lift up the nation's economics. I'm sure you're right about that, and that's because you're a man of God. And I don't want to interject God into politics, but I know it's a big part in your life, and that's how you've been able to withstand the fires that you've been put through recently.
It is a big part, and the reason that I've been able to withstand those fires is because of my faith in God, my faith in myself, and my faith in this country. This is why I'm doing this, Michael, and I got to tell you, the encouragement that I get from people as I travel around this country, the encouragement that I get from the feedback that you get from your listeners, it basically says and reinforces every day the American people are sick and tired of politics as usual. That's why this businessman is appealing to them, because I'm not a politician. And the American spirit, that same American spirit, Michael, that started this country, that brought us through tough times, that same spirit has awakened here in this country. I don't care what you call it. Some people want to call it the Tea Party movement. I call it the citizen movement. And it is bigger, deeper, and more impactful than anybody thinks. The political class in Washington, D.C. is having nightmares because Herman Cain is doing so well. And that's because the American people have awakened and they are not going back to sleep.
Oh, I agree with you. And I said on my show, when you were here, Cain is able. And I thought that was a good, catchy phrase. And somebody's been running those ads on my website paying for them, because it's a heck of a phrase and it's turning out to be true. One other note, Mr. Cain, despite what people are rumoring, I will not accept the chairmanship of the FCC when you're president.
Well, would you be press secretary for a week?
I would be press secretary for you for one day only. That's the first day. That's only the first day of your office. I would only agree to it for one day. I could never take it for more than that.
I may take you up on that offer, because between you and Boyce, I want you to shake them up and give them a new attitude adjustment.
oh, would I shake up the press if they were ever in my room? You know, Mr. Cain, you remember the comedian Jimmy Durante many, many years ago, back in the 50s?
Yes,
I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave the listeners and you with one thought, because this one is great. Jimmy Durante said, "You better be nice to all of them on the way up, and you better be nice to all the people you meet on the way up, because you'll meet them all on the way down."
He's so right. He was so right. Michael, as always, I've enjoyed it, my friend.
Thank you very much, and God bless you. Good luck with the run. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I've told you that the anti-Semitic element of the anti-Wall Street protest movement is being hidden by the vermin in the media, especially the sick leftist vermin who only look at the jeans and who's inside them. And if they see men with tight jeans and blackberries, they get excited like the Arab Spring, which turned out to be, as I told you, the Arab Winter. Don't make any mistakes about it. It's all Soros money. And if you think I'm making it up, then spend a few minutes and educate yourself to where the money came from, who it funded, and how it's involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement. But there's a huge anti-Jewish element of the anti-Wall Street movement that your vermin in the media are not showing you. Listen to clip one.
Clip political one. Leaders are praising Occupy Wall Street.
American people are now occupying Wall Street. Do you support them?
Well, I support the message.
I think it expresses the frustrations that the American people feel.
I'm with them emotionally, viscerally. In my bones, I know they're right.
What is happening at the Occupy Wall Street protest?
Jews control Wall Street!
You're a bum, Jew.
The small ethnic Jewish population in this country, they have a firm grip on America's media, finances.
You got the money. That's why you're fighting, Jewish man. You can't even speak English or Israeli. Go back to Israel.
Why are our leaders turning a blind eye to anti-Semitic, anti-Israel attacks? Tell President Obama and Leader Pelosi to stand up to the mob. Hate is not an American value.
Well, the ad goes only so far. What you should be knowing, you should know, is that President Obama and Pelosi are the mob. Not this. How could they stand up to the mob when they are the mob? They're the ones behind it. They're young. It's an organic movement. They're young. Remember Pelosi glorifying them? What are you talking about? They are the mob. They want this to go on so no one looks at what they're doing. What are you talking about? Why do you think I'm reading love scenes from Abuse of Power? I can't take it anymore. You know who's in the streets. You know that the leadership in this country is non-existent. Now, I got to warn you how dangerous this is. These are the street communists that are acting up around the world, and there's no counter-protests. They have to be stopped by the police in America, and they have to be stopped right away, and I will tell you why. Unless these street rats are stopped right away from destroying cities, disrupting traffic, stopping cars, stopping buses, stopping trains, stopping ambulances, and causing economic havoc in this country, what is liable to happen is what happened in the Weimar Republic in Germany. And that was this. You don't know this because most of you have a twisted educational background. Germany was in economic turmoil after World War I. The communists were trying to take over the country. They did exactly what the Occupy Wall Street crowd is doing, but worse. They were violent. They were beating people up. They were wrecking store windows. They were attacking police. A spontaneous group of Germans arose called the Nazi Party and got into pitched battles with the communists, and it led to the emergence of Adolf Hitler. I am terrified that unless the authorities step in and stop these street rats from causing any more havoc, we are going to see skinheads, Nazis, and other individuals of that variety emerge and get into pitched battles with the street communists, which will lead to the emergence of a radical leader in America on the order of Adolf Hitler. Mark my words. You may not even understand history, but I do, and I'll remind you of something else. Those who do not know their history are condemned to repeat it.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
But if 1,800 companies got a waiver, I mean, that has to tell you that it must not be. It's too expensive if 1,800, if you've allowed 1,800 companies to opt out of this plan.
I couldn't speak to all 1,800 of them, but some of the lists that I have seen have been very, very small companies. They will not have a big impact on the economy of our country.
Dungaree doll, dungaree doll, paint your initials on my jeans, so everyone in town.
So there it is, CNBC. Host Maria, whatever, asking the worst speaker in the history of the world, Pelosi, about the 1,800 companies that have been given waivers from Obamacare. And here's Pelosi lying through her teeth once again, saying that these are very small companies that have been given waivers. 1,800 companies. So that means you could get a waiver, whatever you want, a waiver. You just buy your waiver. When you have a corrupt administration, it's like buying a ticket to a game. If you can buy off a congressman who can get you a waiver, you buy a congressman. If it's a bigger company, you buy a senator. If that's not big enough, you go to an Obama fundraiser and you get a waiver. That's how America works today. We're back to the 1920s, the most corrupt administration in history. So here's Pelosi lying through her teeth to Maria of CNBC saying that they're all small companies that got waivers. So listen to clip 28 when Maria catches her.
McDonald's has been given a waiver. So these are not all small companies. So, I mean, do you regret pushing health care as aggressively as you did instead of pushing a jobs package when you had the chance? Maybe we wouldn't be in this position right now if you had all the guns behind this jobs package as opposed to what you had with health care.
No, that's really not the point.
No, that's not the point. The point is that you got away with it because the people were bamboozled by you and your big hammer in the media. That's how. Next, Maria asks Speaker Pelosi, ex-Speaker Pelosi, about her driving the Boeing plant out of business in clip 29. You got to hear this one.
Do you think it's right that Boeing has to close down that plant in South Carolina because it's non-union?
Yes. I don't know if they could close it down. I would hope that they would make it union.
But this is a corporate decision. Yeah. Should government be getting involved in corporate decisions like that?
Well, they can get. You asked me what I thought, and I told you what I thought.
Can you believe that this woman has been made Speaker of the House in your lifetime? Can you believe that this country has fallen to such a low level where a woman like this, who has no idea what she's talking about, she just pushes the position she's told to push without any responsibility for what she's done? It's amazing to me. And then she's the one. Okay, well, you got the picture of what's going on in this country. Thank God this Maria took her on. Well, one more Maria in clip 30. Listen to this.
I mean, if you're going to say, you know, make a decision on one plant, what else are you going to tell a company?
You asked me my opinion.
Right, your opinion, absolutely.
But the fact is that there's a statement being made in our country about the disparity in income and opportunity for people.
Ah, get off it, would you? One of the richest women in the world, again, playing like hearts and flowers for the poor. How do they get away with this? How? Because you're stupid. Because the American people are just stupid. That's all. Just stupid. That you let her get away with this. So as I said to you, Cain is the antidote to Obama, black versus black. And now we have Maria Bartiromo as the antidote to Pelosi, Italian to Italian. That's what it's going to have to be. We're going to break it down on that level. You're going to have an Italian host on MSNBC, on CNBC, taking on Nancy Pelosi. That's Italian versus Italian-American. And then you're going to have Cain taking on taking on Obama. And that's black versus black. I mean, that's what it's probably going to take because everyone has a special deal in the country. Everyone's hiding behind their ethnicity or whatever. Obama remarks at National Italian American Gala. This is something that I don't even know if I have I don't think I can play this because it's so painful to listen to this. The president goes to the National Italian American Foundation in clip 16. Listen to this. You have to hear it, just one piece of it.
I am biased,
but I think Nancy was one of the best speakers of the House this country ever had.
No, well, there's no hope for this country. See, it's still based on ethnic politics. Here you have Italian-Americans who, and the most Italian-Americans I know, aside from the Sacco and Vanzetti types, by the way, you think that liberals are limited to a certain ethnicity, you're wrong. The most liberal amongst ethnic groups are the Irish. The next most liberal are the Jewish. The third most, if you find liberals amongst Italians, they're horrible. But the majority of Italians I know are very conservative and very patriotic. Inordinately so. Inordinately so. And here they are cheering Barack Obama? Why? Well, I guess you have to watch Boardwalk Empire to get the picture of why they would cheer the president when he comes before them to speak to them about something he knows nothing about, which is how to build business. That's it. So then he tells them how great the country is because of Sophia Loren, throwing that in the same breath with Da Vinci and Galileo and Frank Sinatra. To just show you the debasement of this culture, that we have a man of such a low caliber that he would link Da Vinci, Galileo, Frank Sinatra, and Sophia Loren together. I mean, I know it's politics, but this is idiocy. This borders on idiocy, by the way. I mean, the jokes were tepid. You know, he throws in the Sophia Loren with the big breasts, and everyone goes, how in the world can this country go on in the year 2011 with this kind of low-level mentality? I mean, even the Europeans wouldn't put up with this. Especially them. They have some degree of sophistication. All right, so that covers the sound. That covers the radical red racist media. That covers the bicycles. Now we have Karl Rove, the shill, for Mitt Romney. Karl Rove, who I never liked. He always looked pasty-faced. I don't know. I think you can judge a book by its cover to a certain extent. And I think that Karl Rove, unfortunately, I don't know how to put it to you, every time I've ever seen Karl Rove, well, let me start by saying what he's done that got me mad. He's now attacking Kane, saying that Kane's finished. And he's putting out false estimations of Kane being finished. He was the same man who tried to kill Perry. But we all know Karl Rove is just an organization man who works for the Republican Party and hates anybody who's on the outside, which is why he fits so well with the Leprechaun and the Wallbanger on Fixed News, on Faux News, a wholly owned division of the Republican Party. So now he's attacking Kane. And one of the things I found distasteful about Rove is his looks. There's a certain stereotypical pallid look to him where if I were casting a movie about businessmen within the Third Reich, do I have to finish the paragraph? In other words, if I were looking for a central casting characters to play the portly Germans in the background, I'd pick him right off right out of the line perfectly in Mikhail's Navy or something like that. But aside from that, I mean, the man is horrible to come up with it. How can he do this to poor old Kane? And Kane says, by the way, he doesn't care. And that shows that Kane is even better than I thought. Kane goes up there and attacks him and says that Kane has begun to slide slightly and don't pay any attention to him. Kane doesn't get moved by Rove's attacks, which is another reason that I like him. And he says to Rove about Rove's antics, he says, it's a good thing the voters are not looking at Karl Rove's little whiteboard, because I believe it is a deliberate attempt to damage me because I'm not quote-unquote the establishment choice. Now, he did exactly the right thing. He doesn't get mad. He doesn't get flustered. So they try to attack Kane with this nonsense about women, harassment, and they don't even name the women. We're living in the Soviet Union, Jacques, the French Revolution. Poor women. They were harassed by Kane. He looked at them and, oh my, they were just hurt. Their hearts were broken. And they had to go get a lawyer, and they had to get a settlement. Poor women. Oh, poor women. The weaker sex. Let's take the worst-case scenario. Let's say Kane did say to women when he worked for the National Restaurant Association, let's take the worst-case scenario. So he went out, they were all having a dinner or a drink somewhere, and he said, man, you're good-looking. That's a reason to dismiss him as a campaign? That's a reason to dismiss him as a candidate? He said, you're good-looking? It's unbelievable to me. How in the world could you people buy this? Politico, by the way, was always a shill for left-wing groups. I don't care what they call themselves. You could just see their faces and what they look like. Not one of them has any validity to them. Their credibility has long been gone, but now you know never to read anything on Politico and pay any attention to it. It's a wholly owned subsidiary of the Obama White House. And we're talking about that, and I could see the board is dead, and we got four calls on the bicycles, and I can't move you on once you get them on. And Even the old 103-year-old black woman, I can't move you onto her. Nothing dead. So what am I going to talk about? A nude waitress somewhere? No. Here, to show you what faux news has become. Gingrich's campaign shows signs of life. They take a hack like Newt Gingrich, and now they're trying to elevate him. Why? To undermine Cain in order to promote Mitt Romney. I didn't say Mitt Romney. I said Mitt Romney. He is the McDonald's of Republican candidates. So here's faux news saying, after stumbling out of the gate with staff issues and pricey Tiffany's bills, Team Gingrich may have found footing. Oh, that's nonsense. Gingrich is like an old white wall tire that's been, you know, like retreaded, and they redid the white wall on it. Remember the age of the white wall tire? Gingrich is like an old white wall tire that was worn out. They retreaded it, and they gussied up the white on the white wall. He ain't going to drive that car too far, let me tell you. what else is in the news? It's like glue. It's like swimming through a glue bath today on the Savage. And why is this? I am interested in the news. Two women accuse Cain. So they're trying to lynch him. That's all. It's nothing. It's going to go away. Why in the world would you pay attention to this? And why is Matt Drudge trying to shaft Cain like that? Why would he dignify this? It makes you ask a question about all of the media established figures, including Matt Drudge, who I consider a friend of mine. I don't know what he considers me to be, but he is now becoming the equivalent of the New York Times. He's gotten so big that he's actually morphing into the mainstream media. Cain explains an interview. Cain recalls gesture. Cain this. Cain attacked that. Well, what is he doing here? Why is he running this story? Well, I don't know. You have to ask him. It's his site. He could do what he wants. If he wants, he could do it. Tony De La Russa retiring on top. I don't know who he is. Never heard of him. Illegal alien from Honduras stabs woman to death in random act. It's interesting. I read it every day anyway. I read my site to see what was put up overnight. They're giving Brian Williams a show? You talk about a retread. This guy should be the spokesman for prostate problems. Brian Williams should do a show on how to cure a prostatitis attack. Don't bend. It's sickening. It's like Dan. Where is Dan Rather now that we don't need him? Where is Dan Rather? How come NBC hasn't given him a show? Look what happened to him with one bad remark. You know the business I'm in? One remark can put you out of business. It's worse than a restaurant, which is, one bad meal and food poisoning, you could be out of business. One wrong word in my business, and you're out of business. Look what they're doing to Cain on something he didn't even do. Can you imagine? It's amazing to me. And it's all because, I've said this to you before, but I'm going to say it again. The reason the white liberals who hate blacks are doing this, oh, yeah, you got to understand that. White liberals are the most racist people I've ever met. They hate blacks. Behind their back, they laugh at them. They call him brother whenever they meet him. You ever notice the white liberal? Hey, brother, how you doing? The worst offenders are the ponytails with the bald front, the remarried types who you think they're grandfathers, but it's their first child at age 50. They're the ones who are still like anti-war protesting. And they're all down with the kitchen staff, the waiters from Honduras. And every time they see a black guy, they're so afraid of him, they call him brother, thinking that they can triangulate the guy's rage by making believe that they're one of them. But nevertheless, the reason that they're lynching Cain with this is because they're feeding into the worst stereotypes of black men. They're feeding into the white woman's fear of the black male's sexual prowess all over again. They're doing to him what they try to do to the finest Supreme Court justice we've ever had in modern times. He's one of my heroes, by the way. Clarence Thomas is one of my heroes. But do you remember what the white liberal vermin press did to him or tried to do to him? They're doing exactly the same thing to Cain because the white liberal press is racist to the last skirt, in my estimation. You can take that to the bank. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I want to read a section from Abuse of Power because many of you have been asking me to read my favorite pieces of the book, what I like the best. And let's see, what do I like the best? I like the fact that my character Jack has Asperger's syndrome, a mild case of it. And when he gets, you know, he's an action figure. He's a very good action figure, but he's got a flaw, if you want to call it a flaw. I don't know that it is a flaw. I think that most people are really flawed. In fact, anyone I've ever met is flawed. I know I'm flawed. And the only people who are not flawed are fake people, characters in movies and books who are not flawed. But real people all have flaws, no matter how tough a man may be. Somewhere within inside of him there's a soft spot or a weak spot, and they have to learn how to deal with it. So in my case, I've created a character, Jack, who has a mild case of Asperger's. And when he gets very stressed out, he withdraws to a secret apartment that he has in San Francisco where he works on clocks because his father had been a clock maker, and he learned how to fix watches. And listening to ticking of clocks calms him down. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful part of the book. I'm surprised no one's ever seen that part of it. And so here it is. Let's see. So Jack goes to his secret apartment. Jack thought of his apartment on Union Street as his fortress of solitude. The only people who knew he owned it were his real estate broker and his former wife, and he wanted to keep it that way. A 22-story, 60s-era complex right off the Embarcadero was just a block from the bay. You could elude a rampaging army in this place. One day he'd be smiling and winking at one Norwegian child in a stroller in the elevator. The next he'd be chatting with a businessman from Tokyo. He loved the anonymity of the apartment building. The view from his window was spectacular. Facing north, it looked out across the bay, and just beyond the Richmond Bridge, you could see the East Brother Light Station, a small island lighthouse that had been in operation for over 133 years. Let me pause right there. My novel takes place in San Francisco Bay, in San Francisco, streets of San Francisco, on the Bay of San Francisco, and has scenery that it's not yet been seen in books, ever. Do you know that this book has not been mentioned once in one media outlet in San Francisco? You'd think that even though my politics are different from those of the statists and the communists, they would have to celebrate such a novel after 6 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't.
It is the Savage Nation. We're changing pace a little bit on the show, as I told you. There's only so much I can take of the communists in the gutters of America and the Marxists in the White House. And I've spelled it out for you in Trickle-Up Poverty, and I've fictionalized it in Abuse of Power. So at this point, we move to a different theme altogether. My good friend, I should say my new friend, Robert Davi, is with us now on the Savage Nation. Robert, welcome from Los Angeles. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
So, Robert, let's start with the business part. You have a new CD out, correct?
Get it now on Amazon.
But what is it? You're not imitating Sinatra. It's your own interpretation, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a replication or an impersonation. It's, growing up, I won first place New York State School Music Association solo competition as in high school. I studied with Tito Gobbi in Florence. I studied with Dan Farrow from Juilliard and Samuel Margolis, who taught Robert Merrill. I did my...
I can't believe that you actually studied opera as a young man, because you always play... Basically, you play gangsters in movies, right?
Yeah, well, you know, you start off holding a gun and they keep it in your hand for the rest of your career.
So what, Robert, what was the first movie you were in? Was your first movie with Sinatra a contract on Cherry Street?
That's correct.
And what role did you play in that?
I played Mickey Sinatos, a Greek hitman.
Very
funny. My fate was sealed.
So they never let you put the gun down anymore, that you could never show the sensitive side. So after that, you could never show the sensitive side, huh?
Only in Profiler, when I did Profiler. And I tried to also imbue the characters that I played with a glimpse of some kind of sensitivity, to humanize.
Rob, it's a very interesting thing, Robert. I know you're a fan of my show. You've heard me when I was on in L.A. Now a lot of guys in L.A. listen to me on the Internet or whatever. I don't want to make this about me, but I have a very similar problem. In other words, yes, I believe every word I say. However, there are other aspects to my personality other than the radio show, and yet the illiberals will not let me put the gun down, so to speak.
It's an interesting dilemma, because I know when we have had dinner and stuff, absolutely, it's fascinating, and it's so frustrating. So I never thought of it that it would be frustrating for you, because having the talk radio forum, but I guess it's the same kind of frustration, only being able to express a certain part of yourself. And I guess that's
exactly
why you wrote your book, Abuse of Power. I mean, you know, it's so it lets you...
You're 100% right. That's exactly right. I'm trying to go into another direction. If I could sing, I'd put out a CD. But I can't sing. But when you recorded these songs, the Sinatra stuff, I read you had a 55-piece orchestra. Is that true?
We had 30 pieces for the orchestra. The 55-piece orchestra was at my show that I did in Thousand Oaks that was sold out.
That's amazing. 55-piece orchestra? I didn't even know they exist anymore.
Yeah, well, you can bring them together now and then, Mike. You know, but this on the album, it's a 30-piece orchestra. It was produced by the great Phil Ramone and mixed by Al Schmidt. And we did it at Capitol Records, Capitol Studio, where Sinatra did those great recordings during the...
I would, you know what, Robert, the next time you record, I'd love to be there, because as a man who lives by sound alone, I would love to see a large orchestra recording. I think it'd be a real kick for me, personally.
You would love it, and the engineer we had, the recording guy, Dan Wallen, is... and these guys that I used, Al Schmidt, I mean, and Dan Wallen, they're up there. But they have ears and technology better than any 20-year-old you can imagine. I mean, these are guys that helped build this industry during that golden age of recording.
Well, here's the problem, though. I'm banned in Britain. Am I banned in L.A.? I don't know what will happen once I go through the grapevine. Will the SWAT teams get me?
Pal, you're not banned.
you and the buddies, huh?
Mike.
No, I know. Robert, look, you've been around so long. You must be how many years? How many movies have you done?
You know, Goonies, Bond, Die Hard, Showgirls, Profile, Television, since 1977 when I did that first film with Mr. Sinatra until current. I just did three films this year.
So what makes you want to sing? It's because you began as an opera student and you really always wanted to sing? Is that what you're saying?
Well, in an Italian household, there were two figures, the Pope and Frank Sinatra. Not necessarily in that order.
And that's very funny.
Singing has always been, you know, the Italian tradition. I mean, we listened around the house. You know, I was listening to Caruso, Sinatra, Dean Martin, you know, the great Italian popular songs. And I always had, singing was a...
But wait a minute, you say there were two figures, the Pope and Frank Sinatra. How about Rocky Marciano?
Well, of course. And Joe DiMaggio. But I'm just saying, the two eminent figures, there were every household, not everybody may have liked boxing or baseball, but Sinatra and the Pope, you had to like.
That's amazing. You know, when I was younger, I had some Italian friends, and even though they were from the uneducated classes, as was my family, and there's nothing wrong with that, they just were poor, they loved opera. The Italian families would listen to opera whether or not they had education. That's an amazing fact, and it's disappeared. I don't think anyone listens to opera anymore. Do you? I mean, I didn't say anybody, but it's a very small audience today.
A very small audience, but the... You know, I was very involved, and even Sinatra in his day had the largest, when he was a teenager, he had one of the largest collections of classical music, Sinatra. He was trained on the bel canto technique. He trained from a guy from the Metropolitan Opera, and that is where, you know, this great sound is. I think when we met, we talked a little bit about that voice, and Gary Catona, who's been training me for the last several years, captures that. He has a tremendous technique in terms of the voice and singing.
That's what I want to ask you about, Robert, voice. Okay, I live by my voice, okay, and my brain, putting the two together every day for all these years. And people have said to me, you've got such a wonderful voice. You're an expert on voice. I'm really not an expert. Your voice is what? Are you a baritone?
I'm a baritone.
Okay, what would my voice be?
I would think baritone. I would be a bass baritone. You would be baritone. And
so yours is deeper than mine, right?
You know, You don't know until the singing and then how high you can go. In other words, I've got a, when I sing, my voice, I get about a 3-octave range that I can eke out.
Yeah.
So, but on the timbre of your voice, I would say it's a baritone voice.
But how do you know, how do you learn to sing? How would I learn to sing? I've always fantasized about singing. I sing sometimes to the dog, but I wouldn't dare sing anywhere else.
Well, you know, if you have a passion for it, first it's the, you know, I was so inundated at a young age, and I'm talking about, you know, at 7 years old, Michael, I was down in the basement of my family's house listening to those old wind-up record players my grandpa.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Putting on those 78 records and yes. studying the different voices from opera to even the Sinatra, because the sound there was pure. It wasn't manufactured, you know, electronically. There was a very...
Well, I had old Caruso. My father was a little antique dealer. We had old... I had old Caruso records I listened to on the Victrola, so to speak.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, that's the great tradition with the Italians and Jews, you know.
All right, Robert, here, I'm going to take a chance. You know I'm a guy who takes chances. You ready for this? Let's have some fun. I'm going to try to sing one line of something, whatever comes to my mind, just for you. Tell me what you hear. You ready? This is a signature test. You ready? If it's crap, just say awful, terrible. Don't think about it. Okay?
Go ahead.
Robert, here we go. I need the downbeat. One, two, one, two. Be my love. How's that as a starter?
it's very cute. I mean, be my love. You know, Mario Lanza made that famous. I mean, so I
see, I was just doing it to get some laughter going here. I don't want this to be too stiff. I don't know what to sing. I mean, I could start singing in Hebrew. I would sound better than I would be singing in English. You want me to do my cantor voice? Let me do a cantorial for you. How's that? Then I'll stop it. We'll go back to you.
Mishpocha, do the cantor.
Oh, come on. You're Italian. Stop it. Here we go. Baruchu es Adonai Hamaroch li'olam v'ed. How's that?
That's very good. That was okay. Very good. Nice open.
See, so the next time you have a movie where a Jewish gangster is being buried, let's say someone from the 40s, and you need someone to play a cantor, think of me.
You know what? I will.
You took me seriously.
No, because, you know, I don't know if it'll work out, but I wrote a new script, and there is a cantor in it who teaches my character the song Raisins and Almonds in Yiddish.
I don't believe it.
I swear.
Robert, you know, this is an intriguing part of you. Wait a minute. You wrote and directed a movie, didn't you, that you sent me about 2 years ago?
Yes,
I love that movie. With all your friends were in it, one of them died. The fat guy died, right?
Yes, yeah, Frank D'Amico.
I loved him. I loved him in that movie.
Your show, Frank D'Amico, by the way.
Oh, my God. There's so many guys out there who I would love to know who live for this show because I sound like them or like someone they knew. I never meet these guys. And that goes to the old joke I told you earlier. Lenny Bruce once said an Irishman from New York is more Jewish than a Jew from Cleveland, and you thought that was funny. But the truth is that a Polish man in Chicago is more Italian than an Italian from San Francisco.
Yes. I guess you go, the further north you go up to... It becomes a little bit less, you know. Don't forget all those guys in the South. Same thing in Italy, probably.
Well, what do you mean in Italy? How is it the same in Italy?
Well, no, I'm being, you know, as you get closer to the Swiss and German border, you know, there's a different kind of Italian that goes along.
Oh, of course. That's right. They all try to act like they're WASPs.
You know, there's a different, where the...
No, I remember for years I would hear Italian people say to me, oh, I don't eat that Sicilian stuff, that Sicilian food. I only eat Northern Italian food. And, you know, all the Italian food I ever loved is the heavy, spicy Southern Italian Sicilian food myself.
Oh, it's so good. Even the Southern Italians have, like, my father was...
Hey, Robert, you want to stay on another segment for fun? I don't want to do politics.
Absolutely. Whatever you'd like to do.
Are you kidding? Okay, we'll be right back. Savage.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got that string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love.
I've got a song that I sing. I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me.
Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Michael. And that lyric you said is from That's Life.
Okay, what are the lyrics from That's Life? It's I've been a puppet, a poet, a prawn and a king, or
I've
a pawn
a,
and a king?
A puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, pawn, and a king. I've been
I always thought it was a prawn because prawn. The Italians eat so many shrimp.
That would be scungili then. No, it's not a prawn.
I've been a puppet, a poet, a pawn, and a scungili and a king. Now, you see, Robert, one of the things I loved about meeting you was that you know how to laugh. Why is it that people don't laugh anymore? What happened to this world?
I don't know. They don't understand the absurdity of life.
You know, that's the truth. Is it a generational thing, Robert? I mean, your friends laugh, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes we cry. You know, I just did a film in Toronto, and I got to tell you, there's a community there. I mean, yeah, people laugh. You know, I think the closer you are to an immigrant population.
Yeah. Yes.
The closer you are to your grandparents, if they were immigrants. The more sense of fun, even though the struggle was so difficult.
Yeah, they were poorer, but they knew how to laugh and cry. We're living in a time where people are on so many different medications, and they're also afraid to express emotion, Robert.
They're told not to feel.
Well, I don't know if they're told not to feel. They don't feel. Well, they don't express themselves at work. They're afraid to say anything that they actually believe. The boys are told to shut their mouths in school, and they grow up like rigid dummies. So let's go back to what you're doing. I don't want to get into the philosophical till we have a few glasses of wine and we can sing, That's Amore. When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's Amore. You know, Robert, when I was a kid and I would listen to Dean Martin, which I did very often coming from Queens, New York, I was amazed by those lyrics because, of course, as a kid, I didn't drink. But as I got older and occasionally got drunk when I was 17, 18, the moon looks like a pizza pie when you get drunk. It really does.
Covered in that delicious cheese. It's a little red.
No, but the moon starts to shine like... No, when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. In other words, the drunker you are, the moon shines more, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Those writers knew, boy, let me tell you. And that's the thing.
That's why I don't drink much anymore. Who wants to see a moon that's so big? So, Robert, okay, your album is out. What's the name of it? What's on it? Where do people order it?
It's called Davi Sing Sinatra on the Road to Romance. It was produced by the legendary Phil Ramone. Fontana Universal is putting it out. You can get it in stores everywhere. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it in Barnes & Noble and all different stores, Suncoast. And so wherever things are sold. And
but, Robert, your shows, your singing shows are selling out, I understand, correct?
Yes, they are. And I'm getting, you know, it's embarrassing to say, but even the musicians I'm working with, that some have worked with Mr. Sinatra for many years, giving me, the best thing I could say is go to the website, DavisingSinatra.com, and there are quotes from some amazing people. And
here's what I'm getting at. Why do you think that the singing tours are selling out? What's going on in America? Is there a quest for nostalgia from a different time? When Sinatra was at his peak, America was a different country. It was a far different country, was it not?
It was. But here's the kicker for me. The Great American Songbook is the Shakespeare of America. It's the golden age of American music. And when my parents grew up and times were difficult, this music, even though times were... If a guy was breaking up with his woman, there was a beautiful poetic lyric that was written about it. If you look
yes.
at the song that won the Academy Award in, let's say, 1958, All the Way, as opposed to what won the Academy Award a few years ago, It's Hard Out There for a Pimp. Culturally and emotionally, this
yes.
the music, the American Songbook, which I have to say, it was written, if you look at who wrote that book, Harold Arlen, Yip Harburg. Harold Arlen was a cantor's son. Sammy Kahn, Jimmy Van Heusen, Cy Coleman, Carolyn Lee, Frank Lesser. They were all Jewish.
Oh, quiet. Don't tell that to the Occupy Wall Street crowd. They're liable to say they should be kicked out of America. Robert, let's not get into politics. I know you want to stick to art and music, and I do too, and movies, which is very exciting. But I think it's amazing that you're making a transition from your acting career back to your original love, which is your singing career, which is astonishing to me. But there's another element to this, I think, as a social commentator. I have noted for years now on my show that wherever you go in this country, let's say I'm shopping in Macy's, right? They're playing the music in the background. It's very rarely a male vocalist. It's always this whiny chick music. That's what I always hear. I'm in a dressing room. I feel like sticking myself with pins until to get out of there. I can't even... Yeah, 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 yeah. All you hear is whiny chick music everywhere. It's like bad elevator music. You don't hear the baritones anymore. That's what I'm getting at. Maybe it's because America wants a baritone again, the Dean Martin, the Frank Sinatra, that you're experiencing this success in addition to your talent.
Yeah, I hope so. I know that, you know, I'll be at the Venetian in February, February 23rd, 24th, 25th, and that was where the Sands Hotel used to be.
Huh.
And I'm very excited about that.
I want to be there. Robert, that's one night I really want to fly into Vegas. I want to do that night.
That would be great. It would be great.
What's it like after a show? I know that when I do a live performance, I can't think after a show. When you're through singing, what do you do after the end of a show?
You know, that the moment of doing the show, you know what that is. What that you're on the wire there. You know, it's the excitement. It's amazing. And when you have a big orchestra behind you, and you're connecting from the music is channeling through you to the audience. It's hard to come down afterwards, you know? It's just an amazing...
That's the thing. How can you sit down and have a plate of pasta and talk to anybody? It's impossible. Impossible.
You can't. So you got to have a few drinks first, and then you can talk. You got the
Robert,
tone.
Listen, it's always a pleasure. I wish I lived in L.A. because you and I would become fast friends. I can guarantee it. It's as like we knew each other all our lives as kids, and we kind of separated. Now we're back together again. I hope it grows into something much more than this, and I really wish you the greatest success in your CD. And, of course, I hope to see you way before Las Vegas, but I'll be there with God's will.
All right. Thank you.
Good night, Robert. Thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Savage.